Okay, are you ready to be nervous?
More coffee, more coffee!
All right.
Give her a ring. Hello?
Hi there.
Hey! Can you hear both of us this time?
I can hear you both perfectly.
Hey,
oh, that's brilliant!
Works.
Okay, the first hurdle, we've passed the first hurdle. Now we actually just have to talk about books and shit, and that's easy.
Yeah.
It's the easy part. I can bullshit about books forever.
All right.
Yeah. I drank way too much coffee, so I'm just going.
Yeah, I've been listening to nothing but weird rockabilly and drinking coffee all morning, so I'm totally frantic right now. So we're hoping...
I got practically no sleep. Just took a short, very short nap and have a giant... I'm in my bathrobe with a giant cup of coffee myself.
Yay!
That sounds great!
So, I think we're ready.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, welcome to the Bowie Book Club. I'm Christiane.
And I'm Greg, and I'm really fucking hyper right now.
Wired on caffeine. We've had a two-person book club for like a decade, and we've read a lot of books, and sometimes we talked about them.
Mostly just gossiped about stuff.
But in honor of David Bowie, and after his death last year, we decided to get our act together and read through his inspirational list of 100 most influential books in no particular order.
In fact, in a completely nonsensical order.
And as we read, we make wild speculation about what the books meant to Bowie.
And we gossip about stuff. And this time we're dragging someone else in.
Yeah.
Christiane, you want to do the honors?
So this time we have a special guest joining us, Franz Nicolay. Say hello.
Hi.
There he is.
He is a musician of some renown. In fact, incredible renown. He's got a musical...
I would go with some renown.
Okay, let's...
Came here.
A musician of modesty and renown who has played with just about everybody. Okay, let's go with that. Modest renown.
Words are important.
Who has played with groups as diverse as The Hold Steady, Against Me, his own solo work. He's been all over the place and has done some incredible work in that and is now also a published author.
Yeah, part of the been all over the place. The new book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control from New Press, which I got the pleasure to meet Franz when he was here speaking at Elliott Bay Book Company. It's travelogue through former communist states, sort of a DIY tour and exploration of music and influence in, let's see if I can get them all. So Russia, Bulgaria, Romania. Were you in Czechoslovakia as well?
No. Okay. I mean, I drove through it, but I didn't play any. I played in Prague, I guess. I don't know if that's in the book.
And then the Ukraine, which was kind of a significant period of the tour.
Yeah, Ukraine, but also Serbia, Croatia.
Oh.
Slovenia, Bulgaria, and then Mongolia at the other end.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, the package tour.
That's right.
there was a China chapter as well, but we decided to cut that out in the service of Slavic continuity.
keeping it local, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. and in the service of keeping it under 400 pages.
It was fantastic. I mean, I had been in Romania 2 years ago, so I especially loved reading the Romania and Bulgaria chapters.
Probably about 20 years ago, I did a similar sort of tour through Eastern Europe, not musically related, but just being on trains and buses and dealing with borders and gold smugglers who are bring watches into Turkey and paying exorbitant fees that turned out to be fake. So there's a lot I could relate to in this book.
Yeah.
I got to say, I loved the part where you talk about ultranationalism. And it felt a little dangerously appropriate to the contemporary conditions we might be facing.
Right. It's been amazing to do the book events over the course of the changes of the political changes. I mean, I had to rewrite parts of the book in the wake of excuse me. At first, in the wake of the Russian invasions in Ukraine, because I had, when I first started going to Russia and first started writing the book, Russia was sort of on the edge of world politics. I was writing it as Russia seemed to be like a really declining spent power, and so definitely had to reconceive that. And you certainly, of course, you travel to places in the United States. It's especially places with a troubled political history, there's always the temptation to sort of condescend politically, which you have to check yourself on as well.
I'm try in my desperate attempts to make smooth transitions from book to book, I've been trying to figure out how to tie your book into to the book that we're reading this month, which is Saul Bellow's Herzog. And I was thinking, like, okay, so Russia, right? Herzog's family was originally from Russia,
Yeah, I don't know if any of them are going to fly. I think we better just ask, where did you first hear about this book, and what brought you to read it, and what brought you to choose it for this podcast?
Well, I don't think I chose it for this podcast.
But Bowie did.
But of all the books that we sent saying, like, these are the books that we've been reading,
Did we
right
do it
away.
that way? I was doing it for a class in grad school anyway, so it was convenient that I was already sort of had it in front of me and had some thoughts about it.
So it was
I'm, huh?
assigned.
Yeah, I guess so.
It was a portent.
I don't think I would have picked it up otherwise. Augie March probably would have been the first. I've started a couple times and haven't gotten through. So, having not succeeded with that, I don't know that I would have necessarily picked up a different Bellow to hack through. But yeah, it was on a syllabus.
Ah, okay. And it seems like one of the things you brought up when we talked about the book last week was that it was this huge cultural phenomenon when it came out, and it's not really read anymore. And maybe Bellow overall doesn't have the sort of cachet that he used to.
Yeah, I don't remember Bellow being talked about explicitly in my undergrad English programs. I mean, he's there, he won a Nobel Prize, he has awards named after him that are given to other authors, but I never read him.
Yeah, like you hear about Bellow mostly in the context of influences on other writers that have a much bigger profile these days. I mean, Philip Roth is the one that always springs to mind for me. But yeah, there's something really old-fashioned about this book. Nabokov called him essentially a 19th century writer, and there's, we discussed. I think he's right a little bit about that. It's this sort of novel of ideas, in a way that doesn't really fly in contemporary fiction.
Right, where he the main character, like we were saying before, there's not a whole lot of plot to it. The main character is mostly in his head, and kind of interacting with the world of ideas,
Maybe
and.
that's the tie-in to the humorless ladies.
Ah, okay, there we go.
Not much plot, lots of speculation.
Finally, we have our segue.
Yes. But it's a, you know, in a way, like there's a couple ways in which you can tie it to the 19th century tradition, right? It's this, he's trying to include all his ideas and politics and philosophy and romance, and it's kind of an epistolary novel. Like the letters are never sent, but it's all in these letters.
Oh, that's a great thing. Are they ever sent? I wondered that the whole time. Does he ever send a single letter?
Yeah,
Pretty sure not.
I don't think so. And it's just a way of him trying to organize his thoughts, and the author trying to organize the book using this sort of tried and true literary device.
Yeah, so for in like the Reading Rainbow sense, if I was to like summarize, there's a fellow and he's an academic and he it has been just drastically dumped by his second wife and is going over the errors of his ways, or the errors of other people's ways as they relate to his misery. Not particularly admitting that, well, he skirts around admitting that some of the things that have happened are his fault. But mostly he's just kind of sad about his state of life and what terrible things have happened. And he's looking back over his romance.
Specifically, he spends a lot of time angry at his ex-wife who's left him for their mutual friend, while sort of eliding the fact that he had obviously had several affairs as well.
Yes. Yeah. Just like, well, it's different when I do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that in some ways, I mean, I could see why that leads to the book not being read now, because that's a very old fashioned kind of sexism. Well, I guess I can't say it's old fashioned. Yeah. I mean, what's old is new again, but.
Well, there are a couple of very specifically old fashioned aspects of the misogyny in the book.
Yeah, and I think misogyny is like
misogyny.
The biggest topic we have on our plates for this book.
Yeah.
He ultimately in this story, he's given up basically his former life and kind of gone away from it all, sort of retiring to a rundown country home. And I spent some time debating whether it was an optimistic or at least sort of a quieting, almost like a Buddhist, I have no more desires, I'm just going to focus down and be unambitious in the countryside, or whether it's a totally fatalistic isolationist ending, like I'm split between the two.
Yeah, at the ending he seems to find some kind of peace with himself or with the situation, but is it because he just gives up, or is it because he's decided that it's not worth, or that the struggle isn't worth it, I guess. The struggle to kind of reconcile like body and mind and his relationships. It leaves it sort of ambiguous at the end.
I mean, my take on it was that it's a mania that burns itself out.
Oh.
You know, and it's one of these books that more about a state of mind than a narrative. It reminded me a little bit of Days of Abandonment. It's this one of the shorter Elena Ferrante novels. The woman is also abandoned by her partner and goes through a short period of mental illness essentially, and then comes out of it. And it's a chronicling of that mind state.
Is that the book that Europa is just releasing? That sort of novella length Ferrante?
I think it's been out for a little while, but I'm not positive. I'm not a Ferrante expert by any means. But.
And I think it's sort of, yeah, that totally makes sense in that it kind of traces his arc of this sort of mania that it expresses itself in this sort of letters that go nowhere, acts that go nowhere, sort of these discussions with people that where it seems like there's several places in the book where he has a conversation with someone and they totally flare up and he reacts sort of to it as well. Where what he's proposing to them doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
And well, you can just look at the way that the book is framed. So the first line is, if I'm out of my mind, that's all right with me. So that's,
totally.
And then at the end, he's last paragraph, he's saying the spell really seemed to be passing. He had no messages for anyone, nothing, not a single word. He was done with these letters. Like that to me is the arc of the book, the mania and then the fever breaks.
And maybe the thing that made it such a success at that time is that sort of description of that mental state was new, you know, and at this point, you know, there's been, that sort of openness around how you feel in the wake
like
of a breakup.
The internal world instead of...
Yeah, like the internal world is so much more open in some ways now.
You have this post-war generation, right? There's the influx of Freudian analysis in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's a generation of people who have come out of the GI Bill and they're getting a humanities education, you know, people who would not, of a class or background that wouldn't necessarily have gotten a liberal arts education. And so there's just a probably a you know, this is just a theory, a wider spread sense of interiority and you know, this mind body split.
Yeah.
There's a one of the things that Herzog has is this sort of guilt about choosing an intellectual pursuit. He doesn't come from an intellectual family.
And he's not particularly successful in relation to the other, you know, his brothers who are much more financially successful. So he has, it totally makes sense that like he now has a vocabulary to describe this interior state, which resonated with a lot of people who are also just being exposed to that vocabulary.
Right. And it's a way of describing, I mean, that, I think maybe that's another reason why, the book doesn't speak as much in the contemporary psyche as it did at that time, because what it's describing is the transitional state, right? He's writing about this post-war generation, and the, you know, the move from the physical to the intellectual, but he's a little too old for the real, you know, 60s.
Right.
At one point he says immaturity, a new political category. So he sort of identified the coming generational divide. You know, he sees that there's, you know, a new sexually empowered, you know, women, but it's all very confused. You know, he's not of the generation in the way that, you know, let's not to bring it back to Roth again, but in the way that Roth was.
Right. Yeah. Like Roth was on the front end of the curve, like kind of riding the wave, and Bellow feels like not just in this book, but in Augie March and in like Mr. Sandwich Planet, like always kind of on the back saying like, you know, where, you know, kind of just behind the curve.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely the grouchy old man perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Which,
I mean, it's amazing to think that Augie March, I mean, no, Herzog came out in 64, Portnoy's Complaint comes out in 69, you know, but they feel like they're a million years apart, even, and they were, you know, both cultural sensations in very different ways, but in very different worlds.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it speaks to like how much things changed during those 5 years, just in terms of what people talked about and like what the culture was, what was the culture. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's very much the, like, his idea. He has the line about modern sex and dating. He says food, music, wine, conversation, and sexual intercourse. It immediately reminded me of the thing that Hugh Hefner famously wrote in the
first
play, A Quiet Discussion on Picasso, Nietzsche, Jazz, and Sex. He's like coming from that you know, Playboy and Mad Men sort of early Mad Men generation, and not the real.
I normally don't edit the podcast, but I think I am going to put like a bed of like Dave Brubeck under the Hefner statement.
That's right.
And I loved that Hefner tie-in, and I was thinking about that scene in the book when Herzog is talking to, I think, Madeline, his second wife, to her mother, I think, and just discussing Madeline and she seems to be kind of preparing Herzog for what he's getting himself into. And he makes some comments about like, well, it's a different generation. Like, this is a different generation of women now. And he doesn't say it in any way positively. It's almost like I have no idea what to do about a woman she's going to grad school. She's like pursuing an education, an academic, intellectual life that's possibly more successful than his own and has kind of a declaration of the life that she wants to live, which is in contrast to the women that he seems to praise in the book, which are his mother and the Japanese lover that he has an affair with,
the ones who comfort and take care of him.
Yeah,
I mean, the Japanese woman is practically a geisha stereotype, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and their whole lives are set to comfort and to adore, and versus a woman who has her own mind and pursuits, it's a different world in his mind.
And it made it difficult to read because of that, because I mean, it was one of the reasons, like he's not a likable character, and those characterizations just seem so like stock and boring, really. Like,
in fairness to Herzog, not that a protagonist needs to be likable, of course.
Yeah, totally, totally.
But yes.
but the sort of scenery around him and the sort of like the other players on the stage, or they don't like highlight anything, or they don't bring anything out except that he's old and behind the curve.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that a lot of the protagonists in the books we've read and Bowie's list have been kind of dislikable.
I wonder if that's the theme here. So I guess we should talk about that, is like why Bowie? Why? Which is a question we seem to be asking ourselves every episode now.
Why is it on the list?
Well, Bowie's a hip dude, and he's reading whatever is the hip book, right?
Right.
That's,
yeah.
That's the through line.
Right.
So in a way, it's tracking the progress of the culture, of the, you know, the cutting edge of anti-heroes in literature.
And totally, like, Bowie was like an intellectual chameleon as much as a musical one, where he what was the quote from Carlos Alomaro, who's like, yeah, his intellectual stance is all bullshit, whatever he's reading at the time.
Yeah, he was reading such nonsense, and every time it affected him as though it was the answer to everything.
Right. So this is just another thing that he read in the mid-60s or whenever, and it spoke to him as like, this is where the cultural zeitgeist is. And
it raises a slight suspicion of intellectual pretension.
slight, maybe, perhaps.
It's like to be able to. I mean, there is a thing. You know, there's a, what was I gonna say? You know, to be able to speak to whatever the book is that everyone else is. You know, it's a cocktail party kind of intellectualism.
And I'll just bring that David Brubeck back in. So, yeah, it's totally like, you know, whatever's hip. And that does kind of follow with the other books as well, like at least a couple of them, like Lolita definitely was like the sort of edgy book to have read for,
and probably The Outsider by Colin Wilson when he was young. It was a sensation among, it was like the on the road for the British teenager. Mm-hmm.
Or the intellectually pretentious British teenager.
There you go.
And I guess it makes me curious, though, why there's a lot of things that I've read to keep on top of the zeitgeist, to figure out what's important, what's informing the cultural landscape at the time. But for him to include it on a list of books as one of a limited number of books that was the most influential to me as a person and a reader is interesting.
Yeah, like what did it change about his life to have read this book, or how he looked at things, or how he made music, or how he approached his art? It's really hard to say.
It's hard to see. I mean, you could see Bellow in general, I guess, as the you know, the American realism, blah blah blah. For, you know, first generation immigrant writer, Jewish voice, but this wouldn't necessarily be the one that I would pick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you know, it's possible this is just the one he read.
yeah, it could be. And I guess
you point out, the list is not the list of his favorite books.
Right. It's the list of the books that influenced him in some way.
And there is some themes of, not just the slightly dislikable or completely dislikable narrator, but also kind of the man grappling with approach to middle age and the debate between intellectual and anti-intellectual, like to do art or to do trade. So some of those themes are things that we've seen previously as well, especially that, like, the art, the grappling with, like, do I devote myself to the world of the mind and creativity, or do I just finally crack down and just get a job?
Yeah. And
sure. I mean, I don't know that much about Bowie's class background, but you can, and he doesn't necessarily come across as someone who would have had a lot of insecurity about pursuing a creative life. Like, he went to art school, he went straight into rock and roll, essentially.
Yeah.
You never know what goes on in people's heads.
And our job is to wildly speculate about what went on in his head.
Wildly speculate.
I wonder, now I'm constructing my own alternative narrative, where he read this much later in life when he was, David Bowie Inc., where, mm-hmm. His job was to go do these massive tours and sing China Girl and Let's Dance and I wonder, if the question for him was like, do I kind of retire from this and pursue painting or pursue writing or pursue something where I'm not David Bowie, the rock star.
The quiet country house.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. Right, so you're the town-country divide being the major angle.
Yeah.
I would be curious to hear what he thought of if he ever read Great Jones Street, that early DeLillo novel about a big rock star who goes into seclusion.
Oh, yeah. Wow, yeah, I wonder, that seems to fit his MO a lot more tightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my impression is that one was a little more loosely based on Dylan after the motorcycle accident, but yeah.
So I think it is a valid wild speculation that he read that.
Totally unfounded.
We'll add that to the wild speculation canon.
So another question that we want to bring up to you and to our listeners too is what were the books that influenced you? Like, if you had to name a top five or a top whatever.
Yeah. So that it's not your favorite, because that's one list. Like, if you said your top five or 10 favorite books, but top five or 10 most influential books.
Sure. Well, I can tell you one right away, which was Borges' Labyrinths.
Oh, which, yes.
Which I read in high school and really blew my mind wide open. And for about 10 years afterwards, I would just give copies of that away to people.
Yeah. That just cracks your skull open. It's mm-hmm. It's such an amazing thing.
Yeah. I mean, the books that I really like are not necessarily the same kind of writing that I do, but the ones that really make you work as a reader. So Labyrinths, Calvino, I really liked A Winter's Night, A Traveler, because it was that combination of sort of high concept and very classic romanticism around both romantic and about the romance of being a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nabokov is really my guy.
Any particular titles?
Well, Pale Fire. I love Pale Fire. I love Ada too. That was is really a lot harder to decipher. Lolita, of course, is amazing. But yeah, Pale Fire, just for the complexity of it and I don't like using the word genius, but the genius of the way that it's assembled. I mean, it's such an original book.
I'll have to give Nabokov. I remember you and I talked about Ada when we were at Elliott Bay Book Company, and maybe I should give it another try, or maybe Pale Fire. I should give Nabokov another
Pale
try.
Fire. It doesn't have those aspects that trouble you.
just go right around them.
I mean, if you're looking for an in, or Pnin, Pnin is really the most humanist of his books. It's just this really sweet sort of character portrait of this immigrant professor lost in America, essentially. But Pale Fire, just as structural formal innovation, just game playing, little things that you can discover in rereading it and get those little thrills of figuring out the Easter egg, plot points that are hidden in the footnotes or even hidden in the index. I mean, it's the book that benefits most from rereading and rereading.
Okay, I'm definitely Lolita. Reading Lolita again for the episode last month aside, I'm definitely down to give Nabokov another try. And And going back to Calvino too, that's something that's been on my list of stuff to dig into more.
Yeah, I poke at Calvino every couple of years. I just read Cosmic Comics last month.
Yeah, Cosmic Comics and Invisible Cities are like the great, the sort of fun little conceptual nuggets. But If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler is just a lovely book if you love books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's nothing more I like more than books about books.
That's like, and it's specifically about a romance between two people who fall in love because of their shared love of books.
And how much more romantic can you get?
Well, that's
the pinnacle.
Yeah. It ties it all together.
Yeah. So I think to go back to Herzog a bit, you picked a song.
Yeah, we offloaded all the duties.
Yeah,
onto
you. we made you do all the admin work for this episode. But so what song did you pick and why did you pick it?
Well, it seemed like Queen Bitch was the obvious choice.
Yeah, you can't really. it was the front runner.
Yeah, 'tis pity she was a whore coming up close on the heels. But yeah, we went with Queen Bitch. I think you guys had the same thought. So.
Yeah,
there was something early on in Herzog that I think I wrote the both of you about, where he's on the train or on the bus and he's looking at a woman. Herzog is looking at a woman and he's admiring how beautiful she is and how much every feature in her face looks like a bitch. And right away I'm like, this guy. Like,
this freaking guy over here.
Yeah.
This freaking guy over here. Yeah.
Like, oh, she's inaccessible. These are all the ways that, and it was great. We have the tome that we refer to.
The Nicholas, 5 or 10 pound complete David Bowie collection.
Nicholas Pegg wrote sort of a chronicle of all of Bowie's songs and albums and tours. And there's a great line in it, in his entry about Queen Bitch, that it was sort of referential to a lot of people that he admired, including Lou Reed, the Velvet Underground, and T-Rex, and Lindsey Kemp, and a bunch of and sort of in a way little letters of admiration to people in his life. But then also he says at the end of a sentence, "This is a song that succeeds in making the phrase bippery boppery hat sound raunchy and cool."
I have a hard time with that.
Yeah.
All right. So do you have things coming up that you want to tell people about?
What's coming up? I'm giving a presentation at the what they used to call the EMP conference in Seattle.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Think out op conference.
Nice.
So that's the Friday night of that. That's at the end of April. I'm on a panel with John Langford from the Mekons, Jen Pelly from Pitchfork, Grail Marcus from Grail Marcus, and Damon from Galaxy 500 talking about punk and politics.
Oh, awesome. That sounds great. So cool. So, yeah, we'll definitely we'll link to that in the show notes. And yeah, I'm really psyched about that.
And everyone should go out to their local bookstore and purchase a copy of The Humorless Ladies of Border Control.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book.
And not only that, it's beautiful. Like, it's aesthetically pleasing to look at this book.
Yeah.
I got to give my sister Sophie credit for that, who did the design.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the illustration on the cover.
Well, what we sort of figured is this is a book that's on the face of it kind of a niche interest. So the more we can make it a beautiful object that all these bookstores will want to put on a table, the mm-hmm. more we people to put up and at least get it in their hand.
Totally.
And you mentioned previously, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but you mentioned that you're working on another.
Yeah, I've got two books in various states of completion, one of which is a novel and one of which is another nonfiction. And I don't want to get too detailed about it. The nonfiction one has sort of foundered a little bit on the shoals of 70 hours of interviews that need to be transcribed.
Which is
why I was saying I would not, wish that on you. But yeah, one of the two of those will be out sometime in 2 years.
Well, I definitely look forward to that for
Yeah.
sure, and look forward to what you come up with musically and other art stuff.
Other
Well,
art
thank
stuff.
art stuff.
Sorry, I think the coffee's wearing off.
Hot steaming piles of new content.
And
Take it away.
on that, I think there's no better way to end it. But we do have to talk about what book we've got coming up next,
Oh yeah,
because
next.
it's pure evil.
I guess, yeah, Maldoror. It's a long form poem by Comte de Saint-Laurent, and apparently it was big influence on a lot of poets like André Breton, some of the surrealists.
And
So.
I'll read to you a short excerpt from it, which I got from Necronomy, which is a site dedicated to Satan. O octopus of the silky glance, you whose soul is inseparable from mine, you the most beautiful creature upon the terrestrial globe, you chieftain of a seraglio of 400 sucking cups, you, and I'll put the metal filter on this one. Whom are nobly enthroned as though in their natural habitat by a common agreement and with an indestructible bond, the divine graces and the sweet virtue of communication. Why are you not with me, your belly of quicksilver pressed to my breast of aluminum? The two of us sitting here together upon a rock by the shore as we contemplate the spectacle I adore.
Did you say your breast of aluminum?
Breast of aluminum.
That sounds like Bowie lyrics. It's more like Scott Walker lyrics, I guess, but
There's
they
gotta
started to converge toward the end.
be a metal band out there already that's got these as their lyrics.
And we'll research that and we'll bring it to your awaiting ears next month. So thank you again, Franz, for chatting with us. This is,
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's
it's great.
fantastic.
And I guess we'll how can people
Well, so you how can people get in touch with you, friends?
FranzNicolai.com.
Awesome.
FranzNicolai. COM. That's all the stuff.
So we'll set that to music and we'll play it out over the end. And people can get in touch with us through
BowieBookClub.com
and on the Facebooks
at Bowie Book
pod
Pod.
and on the Twitters. We always forget what the Twitter one is. I think it's also Bowie Book Pod. Anyway, it's all in the show notes. We'll link to all the books that Franz mentioned, all the other weird stuff we talked about, and we'd like to find out what your most influential books are too. So definitely let us know through Facebook or through Twitter, what books stuck with you.
Yeah, I'm gonna start making my list.
Yeah.
And I think it's weird.
Yep. Okay, so be prepared for weird satanic poetry next month.
Thanks again, Franz. It was really great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, cool.
Okay. I think that went well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely great getting to talk about books and all sorts of
I
other stuff
know. I
too.
love it.
The one thing I wanted to mention that I forgot about was
Oh, the CPR.
the CPR, the orangutan CPR, which I think is the highlight of the book. My weekends at an all-time low. Cause she's hoping it's a scar, so I can't see her letting him go. Walk out of her heart, walk out of her mind. I love her. She's so switchy in her satin and tan. In her frock coat and bibbidi-bobbidi hat. Oh God, I could do better than that. No time ambassador, a sweet talking night walking game.